You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. A bill to prevent wage theft in the Gem State passed out of committee yesterday. Currently, Idaho law allows a worker to file a claim for unpaid wages within 6 months of those wages not being paid. The bill modifies the current law from 6 to 12 months. Joining me live in studio to talk more about this is Representative Matt Erpelding, who brought the bill forward. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Gemma. It's great to be here.
So tell me, you know, how the current law works right now. I mean, I gave a brief overview. It's a little bit more in depth than that.
Yeah, the current law is all over the place. So, for example, if you have an overtime dispute with your employer, that would actually go through the U.S. Department of Labor. And if you are just flat out not paid by your employer, so you work for 2 weeks and then they refuse to pay you, you have 2 years to file that claim. But if you're if you work for your employer for a full year and during that time, whether intentional or otherwise, they're shorting you on your paycheck, you only have 6 months to go back and claim what's yours. And so to the degree that people sometimes find that they've been shorted by their employer when they go to do their taxes, they're not able to collect all the wages that are owed to them because our statute of limitations says you're only owed 6 months.
What's interesting to me about this when I heard about it was like, how in the world would you know, would you not recognize if you didn't get paid the adequate amount? However, according to a report by the Economic Policy Institute, wage theft apparently is a huge issue across the entire country.
Well, it's with a six-month statute of limitations right now, there are currently 934 open claims with the Idaho Department of Labor worth close to $1.5 million.
So, holy cow.
Wage theft is a problem.
Okay.
Now, it may not be intentional. It could be a withholding problem, or it could be getting shorted on hours. So I work 10 hours, but I only get paid for 9.75 hours. All of those problems coalesce into this idea that the way that our law is written is if you just are paid part of your wages, well, that makes it so that the employer is really not penalized and there's a statute of limitations, so you can't actually get wages if you figure it out when you go to do your taxes.
Because when you were looking into this, because you brought this forward last year, is that most people, as you said, don't figure this out until they go to file their taxes. We file our taxes once a year. And then all of a sudden, you could potentially have 6 months where you cannot even try to get any of that money, correct?
Correct. The way it is right now, you know, there's two times when people will file wage claims. They'll file a wage claim the Monday after payday, which means they get their paycheck and they go, whoa, this isn't right, and they immediately file a claim. Or the more insidious type is where it's a very small amount and your withholdings are very complex and you don't notice it until somebody goes to prepare your taxes and they say, this doesn't equal this. And they go and they do it when they're filing taxes. Now, in a perfect world, we would be in alignment with the federal law for overtime and with the state law for just fully skipping out on paying wages, which is 2 years. But 1 year is a good positive step, and it helps align with some of the documentation that the Department of Labor asks for, which is your W-2 form right out of the gate.
So where does the bill go next?
So the bill is probably going to be up on the House floor on Friday morning, and there was a little bit of opposition inside of the committee. The opposition came from on my fiscal note, the Department of Labor estimated that if you if at 6 months we have 934 claims worth $1.5 million, if you extend that to 12 months, obviously claim numbers are going to go up and the value of those claims are going to go up. So they estimated that they might need a couple new employees. And there were members of the committee that flat out opposed that and said they would have voted for it if the fiscal note was de minimis, but the fiscal note was essentially two employees, and that's top level. But for the most part, it came out with a 10 to 2 vote, so that's pretty good. And hopefully we'll have a vote on it on Friday on the House floor.
I'm speaking with Representative Matt Erpelding talking about his wage theft bill that he has brought forward. Want to shift gears and talk about another bill. This is the historic theaters being able to sell beer and wine. So talk to me about this, because I just assumed they could sell it, but they can't.
Yeah, and sometime around 2006, Idaho began to kind of work on its alcohol, where minors and beer can be located and who can sell beer and wine. And in that process, they made a real clear delineation that if you're a movie theater and you sell beer and wine, you need to have a completely cordoned off area. So, for example, Meridian, they've got that top deck where you can have a beer while you're watching a movie, and the bottom deck is for all ages. The problem with historic theaters is twofold. One is they're historic, and so they're unable to modify their floor plan to meet what ABC has asked for. But then second is most of them are multipurpose theaters, so they have a stage up front, which adds an additional complication. Live performances, you can have beer and wine. A film festival, you can have beer and wine. But if it's a movie, you can't have beer and wine. So what this does is it says we expect our historic theaters to be some of the most responsible people in their communities. This will help these small communities keep their historic theaters open, and it helps provide them with a more clear path for when to sell beer and wine.
And that's an interesting point because, I mean, the historic theater in Boise is the Egyptian.
Yep.
We have the largest population. But when we go to smaller areas of Idaho, there are historic theaters. And you're right, that's kind of a gray area.
Yeah, absolutely. And I had worked with the Egyptian to kind of figure out the lay of the land and what we thought was okay. But then the Panada Theater in Sandpoint is actually the one that approached me on the issue because when you start introducing catering permits, you then involve the city that they're in. And so it's just a complexity that what this does is creates a much more level playing field, and it helps. You know, many of these historic theaters are in nonprofit status. They're owned by a foundation. They're maintained by doing all kinds of different shows. What this does is provides them an economic tool to help sustain the value that they bring, the historic value they bring to their community.
Well, and you would think it would affect people that go to the theater, because let's say you go to the theater for a live performance and you can get a beer, and then 2 weeks later you go for a movie, and all of a sudden it's like, nope, you can't have that. So it sends weird messages, it
seems
like.
It's confusing.
Yeah.
And I think that was the reason to bring this, is it's confusing. And so the bill is very specific. It's theaters built before 1950 that are also on the National Register of Historic Places. And so what that does is it really confines the theaters into, you need to be a very old theater, you need to bring historic value to your community, and thereby, to demonstrate that, you need to be on the National Register.
And how many are there in the state of Idaho?
You know, roughly that are open and operating, there's about 13. There are a few others that would be impacted by this if they were ever able to refurbish themselves and reopen. The one that I think of the most is the Pix in Nampa. So it's located right there in downtown Nampa. It's a very old theater, but it's currently under remodeling, and they're trying to refurbish it and raise the money to be able to finish that refurbishment. But if they were able to do that, they would be eligible for this.
So where is that bill in the process right now?
So that bill is currently on the third reading calendar. It passed out of committee pretty easily earlier this week. It's on the third reading calendar, and we just didn't get to it today. So then after assuming, I've got about 17 House sponsors, all from districts that have a historic theater for the most part. Assuming it gets out of the House, then we would repeat the process in the Senate.
And then you were in with Boise Police Chief Dennis Stone back before the session started, talking about first responders.
Yes.
So for people that might not be aware, talk to me about this bill that was introduced originally.
So the bill, which has now passed out of the Senate, it is on the calendar for Thursday in the House Commerce and Human Resources Committee. So it's beginning, hopefully, the last leg of its journey, would provide firefighters, police officers, dispatchers, and EMTs with access to post-traumatic stress injury treatment through the Workman's Compensation Insurance Program. And that was removed in the 90s when there was a stigma about mental health. And we know that these folks, these first responders that do the absolute best to keep us safe, they see things on a regular basis that most of us would only see in our nightmares. And it's time for us to help get them the treatment they need to be able to continue to do good work.
Has this been an easy bill to get to where it is right now?
It has not been an easy bill. I mean, when Chief Doan was here, he worked on it in the 90s. After they had removed it, he tried to bring it back to advocate for our first responders. And it was completely shut down. So here we are 20 years later. And, you know, mental health in the United States has been stigmatized so poorly and so badly that, you know, our first responders are even uncomfortable coming forward and saying, this is a really painful thing and it impacts my daily life. And when you look at the numbers of first responders, more first responders have taken their own life than have been killed in the line of duty over the last 5 years. They suffer from some of the highest divorce rates in the country. They suffer from substance abuse. And a lot of that can be traced back to their own mental health. And their own mental health is clearly and convincingly often decided by the things that they have to deal with when they're on the job.
And that absolutely goes back to the point of it being covered under workers' compensation instead of having to take it out of their own pocket to deal with what they are seeing on the job.
Yeah, I mean, if they hurt their back or they hurt their ankle, we consider that an injury. And 20 years of seeing really traumatic events, that is also an injury, and it's time for us to do the same. I mean, the current law says if you hurt your back and you need and you have a psychological injury, we'll give you coverage. But if you just have a psychological injury, we won't give you coverage. And we need to fix that, and we need to recognize that PTSI is a real injury caused in the workplace, especially for our first responders.
And it's interesting, I think, to think about how far we've come as a society in 20 years. There is more work to be done when it comes to mental health, but people weren't even having conversations.
Right.
20 years ago.
I mean, I got a degree in psychology in 1997, and so I started it in 93, and we only had cursory discussions about PTSD back then. And it's been something that we've swept under the rug for 20 years, and more we need to have conversations about. In addition to our physical health, what are we doing to ensure our mental health?
And what was interesting when you and Chief Doan were here was I remember him saying, or people leave the profession because of the PTSD, and then you have to train new people. And then there is this cycle where if we can get people help, then they can continue to do their job and do a good job.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, when you talk about senior firefighters or senior police officers leaving their job because they just can't handle it anymore, that's a lot of experience. That's a lot of time that they've put in to become an expert at their job. And to lose that in the middle of their career is actually a big expense to cities, not just the institutional knowledge and the skills that they brought to the table, but also having to finance training new employees and get them back up to that same level. So this is important.
So come Thursday, it will hopefully be at its final.
On Thursday, it will have its full hearing in House Commerce and Human Resources. And after it passes out of House Commerce and Human Resources, which I feel very good about, it will get voted on the floor sometime next week. And then it will go to the governor.
And then we'll see what the governor does.
Yep.
I want to thank you for coming in today and talking about this. My guest today, Representative Matt Erpelding. Thanks so much.
Thank you.